FM Rewind, Vow 88.1. Science Wise on Vow 88.1.
So on today's show, we're having a guest, Kalibito. His name is Sibuso Biela, a dedicated science communicator and freelance science writer passionate about making research accessible to the public. He's a senior producer for digital news at the SABC, creating data-driven stories and visual content. In addition, he's the host of Ilukuluku podcast, a Zulu pop science podcast with years of experience in science communication, including projects with Sansa, SKASA, and SASTA. It provides unique insights into how science can be shared in engaging and in impactful ways. Without wasting any further time, let's give a warm welcome to Mr. Sibuso Biela. Mr. Sibusiso.
Hi.
How are you, my leader?
Thank you for having me. I'm all right. Thank you.
All good. I don't want to waste any further time. Just want to jump straight into it. So can you please just tell us, what is science communication in your own words, and why is it important for the public?
Okay, so the way that I usually explain what science communication is, everything that we know about science as a public, if you're not a scientist, and to some degree if you are a scientist, is has to be communicated to you somehow. It doesn't take all of us becoming PhDs or experts in certain topics to know and hear about them. There's lots of things that we hear in the news, some advanced science happening, some interesting things happening in the world, or just interesting things we know about the universe, about some science news happening in the country. That's essentially what science communication is. Mm-hmm. So there's people who are doing the science, mm-hmm. and then there's people who know about the science. In order to move from the science being done to other people who are not doing the science, knowing about it, including policymakers, including the general public or anyone else who might be interested, there has to be an intermediary between those two sectors. So that's what science communication is, essentially, just bridging that gap in the science and people who don't do the science, in a way, yeah.
Mm. So as a freelance science writer, right, out of curiosity, what are some of the challenges that you've encountered in your journey thus far?
So I would say, if we start from the beginning, it's been like this is my dream career, right? Mm. So this thing that I'm doing, being a science communicator. But growing up, I did not know it was a career, mm-hmm. That you could make a living off it. Like, I always thought it would be a fun thing to do after school, after I'm done with school and university. But what ended up happening is that it's something that I did growing up. Mm-hmm. I just liked explaining things to people. And the reason I liked explaining things is because I would always see myself as being incredibly curious and then learning something that I've always wondered about for a long time. And the joy that comes from having my curiosity satisfied, and just like knowing the technique that we use to get the information to me so that I understand. It's like, it feels like yesterday, the difference between yesterday and today on any days that I learn something new. Mm. And that joy, I find it to be infectious when I explain things to other people. So the challenges started there, that I didn't know it was a viable career in the first place. Mm. And also the challenges that continue is, I would say, like with every, maybe if you're talking to a scientist or anyone else in the field, it's always a funding issue and a support issue, right? but I think with that challenge comes a lot of opportunity, such as just using whatever materials you have to make making the best of the little resources that are available, which is, I guess, the motto that a lot of people working in science in Africa would tell you about. Like, we do, here in Africa, we do a lot more with a lot less. So, so there's challenges, there's opportunities, but the challenge for me personally was not knowing that it's something that I can make a living off of in the beginning. And I got very lucky to find out that that is the case. And honestly, I don't know what else I would be doing if I wasn't doing this for a living. But
sure.
Yeah, Yeah, that's the personal challenges, and then there's the bigger, broader ones as well.
Speaking about challenges, it's also very important that we also speak about your highlights as well. Can you please, just if you don't mind sharing, what are some of the highlights that you've encountered during this journey that you would be able to share with us at this current moment?
Okay, so some of the highlights has been from the beginning. I've been basically working as a science communicator since 2011. I was still at university doing my chemistry and physics degree at the University of Zululand in KZN. And I had the opportunity to write for a local newspaper. And in it, every week or every other week, I would write what you call opinion columns. And lucky for me, the editor would let me write about anything I wanted most of the time, it was about science. And with that, I was able to inject a lot of science stuff in sections of the newspaper that you'd usually find something about sports or politics or current affairs that are not related to science. But I was able to inject science every week in any way that I could, sustaining general scientific things, talking about things of interest that are happening in the world that are related to science, things that excite me about science. Like, it was a way to try to change people's minds about, like, their idea of science, that it's something that you should avoid because it's difficult, but it's something that, besides just knowing that it's all around us, it can be that it's something that we can enjoy, and also realizing that it affects your life, whether you are aware of it or not. So it would be better to be aware of it in terms of just nature itself existing, and also the decisions that are made regarding science. And just there's so many things happening in South Africa, especially with our past and present of HIV prevalence and treatment, with the other pandemic as well from 2020 being COVID. And a bunch of other things happening with the FKA, like you mentioned, the square kilometer array, climate change. Like, there's so many things that affect our lives that are touched by science and research. So,
okay.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, you were asking about my highlights. Sorry.
Sorry. I was just like, damn, another, brother's going in.
Yeah. So another highlight is that I found out a couple of years ago that I have what's called ADHD. So that might explain why I trailed off there.
Oh, bro.
But
I know, right?
Yeah. And like, so growing up, I used to blame myself a lot for not finishing tasks, and teachers would be frustrated with me that I seemed to understand everything they were teaching me, but I was incredibly lazy or forget to write assignments, but like I knew everything. So there was the whole thing, and I've learned a lot more about that. But coming back to the highlights themselves, yes, ever since I was diagnosed a couple of years ago, like all those things keep coming back. Like, oh yeah, that's what was happening. So in 2017, I got the opportunity to go to the U.S. In San Francisco for the World Conference of Science Journalists, which is happening again, but this time in South Africa in December. But more on that later if you want to discuss that. But in attending that meeting, I had the mandate of talking about what I called the decolonization of science, which is the idea that science isn't something that just came from Europe wholesale, that it's not something that's not meant for us, because growing up in South Africa, you have that idea that things that are technological or scientific, they're not for us. They're not for us, black people. So it still persists to this day that you are in school and you're told that you shouldn't really do science. Tough. You have to be incredibly smart to understand science in the first place. So, or that if you are a black person who's a scientist, that you're special. It is a very special thing to be, but I dream of a time where it isn't the biggest of deals. Like, the big deal is the science that you're doing, right? Like, let's say we're still getting a lot of the first black woman PhD in something or other things like that. So my highlight from the 2017 thing was that I was able to give the presentation, and from that It spawned a lot of articles that I wrote and articles that were written about me.
Mm.
And basically, it was just using language as well to talk about sensitive topics in African language like isiZulu.
Mm.
Like that practice of trying to come up with words for certain scientific things, which then led to the podcast that you mentioned as well, and a couple of scientific publications that I've been a part of, and some projects that stem from this. So I was being cited in scientific articles based on a blog that I wrote for a journalism, science journalism blog for the Open Notebook, because it was such a fresh idea that people who are writing about this specific topic, there wasn't many scientific papers written on it, right? So that was the highlight, being my article, blog, being cited in science communication papers. So yeah, that's been, I guess, one big highlight that I can think of.
Mm, no DNA, just RSA, my brother.
So
speaking about Mzanti, why does effective science communication matter specifically for South Africa, and why should people care?
Okay, so like I said, science affects our lives, and so does science communication.
Mm.
So the thing about science communication is that we have to understand that those of us who love science, we should never forget that it can be abstract and difficult and difficult to make sense of, or some facts are hard to accept. So the way that science has been portrayed in the media, which is how people know about science if they don't go to universities themselves, is that scientists either possess all the knowledge or none of it, and they're just lying to us, right?
Mm.
So it's that perception creates this idea that when scientists come out and say they don't know something, they're supposed to know, right?
Mm.
But that's a big tenet of science, that there's lots of things that are unknown, but the point of science is that they can be known, or scientists will try to learn of a certain truth if they don't know about it. But also, the journey to a final truth, there's usually a lot of knowledge that they gain along the way, even if they never get to a certain truth that they were looking for. That's the whole point of science. Like, it's just It's a way of thinking, right? So a big example of this and how it affected the world, basically, was when COVID happened. I remember back then we were still calling it the coronavirus. And when it was changed to COVID-19, some people weren't happy about that because they didn't understand how usually these things work, right? So it's scary living in a world where something as scary as COVID happens, and you are told by scientists that they're still investigating. They don't really know exactly what this is, but they had some experience and they'll get back to us on that. So, right. So it felt like the government was lying to us and that sort of stuff. So this understanding of how people see scientists and how they do their work clashed with how scientists actually do their work. Like not knowing things for the general public is a negative for us, but for scientists, that's a positive. It means there's something that can be there's this curiosity, there's this knowledge gap that they can try to work at and make sense of. So that disconnect of how scientists actually work and scientific research and how it works and how people understand that is very much based on the science communication that we do experience. So if our science communicators don't talk about the work that scientists do, the challenges that they encounter, what actual work and time goes into the research that they do, if we don't tell the public that, someone else will. Someone who is out to just tell a good story, an exciting story, but not so much a true story, a true representation. And much as we saw with COVID and how people reacted to the vaccine and the data and understanding of how the virus works, it's a huge indicator of what happens when those two truths, I'll say that. So that's why I think, if I'm still answering your question, that's what I think about the importance of effective science communication, that it demystifies what a scientist does, what research is, what science is in the first place. So it's not just talking about all the cool things that science is doing or stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay. So when big events happen, like the blood moon lunar eclipse we witnessed on Sunday, how do we decide which science stories deserve attention? Are all science events worth sharing, or are some for trends, Inje?
That's a good question. I suppose that's something that I think about myself. I guess one of the things that I would look into is there's stories that deserve to be told, but the limiting factor, the bottleneck there would be your resources, right? And your availability and what story you want to tell. So sometimes it's just only one person. I want to be able to give this story the attention that it deserves, knowing that if I don't do it well enough, there might be a lot of miscommunication. So there's just that understanding of how much people maybe just interpret a certain thing. Like, I don't want to, as a science service, I don't want to oversell a scientific discovery or anything like that. And also, I don't want to perpetuate this idea that that a lot of scientists have when it comes to science journalists or journalists in general, that they don't want to talk to us because we tend to sensationalize things. I want to, whenever I put out a story, to like be another brick in the tower of good science journalism. So in terms of deciding what stories are in there, you work with your editor. Sometimes there'll be, with the blood moon, there'll be even the name blood moon. It is sensational in a way. So with the blood moon, the recent lunar eclipse, I took some photos of it myself, and lightly edited the pictures for clarity and made sure they weren't too bright or too saturated or anything like that. I wanted it to be what a person would see if they looked up at a lunar eclipse. I didn't want it to be too bright, because there were a lot of really weird edits of super bright like images that, if you were to see that, is you expect it pink, but it's more of a light brown being to the point of being dark, that the moon almost disappeared. So the stories that, in essence, I decide on, one would be the resources that are available. Two, what story am I telling? What pitfalls can I avoid? All those sorts of things. So it's like with any journalism thing that you encounter, is this story of public interest, right? So I work as both a science communicator and as a science journalist, and there's a small difference, or a big one, depending on who you ask, between those. So as a science journalist, you do some form of science communication, in that there are certain things that you'll be explaining in your story, and that's a form of science communication in itself. But mostly when people talk about science communication, it's usually a communications thing, like public relations. If you're working at a university, you are basically cheerleading for a new discovery, all this sort of stuff. So that's just science communication in a nutshell, but there's a lot more to it. And there's journals that exist, there's lots of research that's done, there's lots of people who do different forms of science communication in that way. So the story that I decide on then is, what can I do as a science communicator here, right, in order to explain a good story? Is it going to change people's minds? depending on how I explain it, might it have some effect on how people see a certain topic, right?
Mm.
Like, for example, you look at writing stories about the SAA, right? Or anything that's space-related or astronomy-related, right? So it might be that it's difficult to show people how important radio astronomy is, right? Like with the SAA, without showing amazing, dazzling images.
Mm.
But like the truth is that a lot of the science that the researchers will be doing won't include a lot of images. Like it'll be a lot of data in spreadsheets and things like that. I don't want to create this perception that this is what radio astronomy is. It's these dazzling, amazing images or anything like that. Those do exist as well, right? So it's a lot of things that I have to weigh as a journalist and as a science communicator. None of them is, I don't want to spread misinformation. I don't want to overemphasize or oversell scientific discovery. And just what resources are available for me to tell a good story from for that particular science topic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So South Africa has 12 official languages, but English dominates science. Why is incorporating indigenous languages important, and how do you approach it, especially in your work?
So the big motivator for why talking about science in indigenous languages is important is there's just something very precious and special about the things that we're able to talk about in our own languages. We can talk about sports, politics around the braai or at home, in our native tongue. But when it comes to scientific things, we have to change language that we're forced to, right? So we either choose not continue on that topic because now we have to code switch, right? Or we have difficulty with that language switch, that it sort of changes the way you think, or it creates this idea that if you can't talk about something in your own language, then it's not really something you should care about, something you should worry about so much, right?
Mm.
So it's frustrating if you're someone who loves and understands science, but the one barrier that's keeping people from engaging with you on that topic is the language one, and there's nothing much you can do because the words don't exist, right?
Mm.
So it's important to do science in our native languages. And one example of this is, so Afrikaans is considered a linguistic miracle of the 20th century when it comes to technical and scientific discourse.
Mm.
Because starting in the 70s, the apartheid government put in a lot of resources into turning the language into a language of science, writing books, creating lexicons. And to this day, you can write your exam in Afrikaans or in Afrikaans or in English for physics, biology, and I think some of the other scientific subjects as well in school.
Mm.
And you can do that in at university as well in Afrikaans, but you can't really do that in African languages. And it's not because these African languages are incapable of the abstract and complex thought that is needed to cast these ideas in science. They are capable. It just takes a lot of resources to do that. So, that's why it's important to try to create resources to talk about science in our own languages, because it goes back to the idea that I mentioned before, the decolonization of science, that it's difficult to try to decolonize science, and then in order to speak and engage in science, you have to speak English because it's the only way you can do it, right? So, that's the big idea to why I think it's important to engage, to have some science discourse, scientific engagement in African languages. It's just that the resources aren't there yet, but it is possible to.
Mr. Zwusizo.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I think you kind of didn't hear the last part. But I just want to ask, like, what results have you seen from using indigenous languages or new formats such as podcasts on audience engagement? Any success stories that you can share with us?
So I have this, I'll say a friend and colleague, his name is Ennis Ntutu Mbili. He's currently in Singapore at the moment for the next week or so. And he is over there, and it's at night. Earlier it was at night around 8, but like it was still maybe around 1 here, right? And he was, he has a regular segment on Ukhozi FM where he talks science stuff, right? And he took the opportunity while he was there to just tell people on Facebook that, hey, I'm in Singapore. The time zone is 6 hours in front of everyone else here in South Africa. It's at night, as you can see, even though it's the day there, and I'll be talking to people live on Ukhozi FM. And so, like, we do know, and we've seen maybe on TV, you can do it in English and all that stuff, just talking about time zones and things like that. But that little engagement of saying, hey, we're here in South Africa, right? Like, there's that disconnect that, like, yeah, we usually talk about that, but not in isiZulu. So having someone over there talking science stuff to South Africans live, like, it might not seem like a big deal, speakers talking about that stuff in English, but in isiZulu, it is a huge deal. Like, you don't find a lot of that discourse there. So it's Ennis is one of those people who's not let the lack of resources stop him from creating scientific discourse in this thing. And that post on Facebook, it got so much engagement, like, within minutes. And it's really fascinating. I'm really very happy to see that sort of engagement happening, that we are trying with the little that we have to do the most, right? Please. And you can see the excitement that people have of science, the questions that they have, things that they wouldn't be comfortable in asking in English, not because they don't know the English language. They do. It's just more comfortable and more, you can engage more in your own language, a language that you grew up in, a language that you don't have to translate in your head every time you think about it. Because if you have to translate English in your head, if you're not a native speaker, you're also translating the science that you're learning as well every time. But if you're able to talk about and think about science in your own native language, you don't have to go through that extra step. You own the idea of science. You understand nature in that way. So yeah, that's I would say one of the big highlights, I think, when it comes to the use of science communication in indigenous languages. And there's been some work that I've tried to do as well, including the use of AI, which started a couple of years ago, I think 2018, 2019, before the big COVID thing and the big open AI thing with the general, not general, the generative AI stuff. So it's encouraging to see the sort of stuff being done, and I'm hoping that moving ahead in the future, we'll be able to do a lot more of that, of that work.
So what does the future of science communication in South Africa look like? If resources were unlimited, what should we be creating?
So in my coverage of certain science movements happening in South Africa, Minister Blame Zimande, like Minister of the Department of Science, Technology and Innovation, has been pushing a lot the idea of science engagement, with him saying that, like, what good is science being done if people don't know about it, right? So I'm very happy, because there's a lot of, I'll say, policies being put in place that will entrench science engagement as going hand in hand with science communication, right? So you want science being done going hand in hand with the science communication as well, but not in the way of just only informing people about what scientists are doing, but as a way of scientists know what people know about science, right? To understand how they're perceived, for them to engage with the public, because them engaging with the public affects how people see scientists and how they see science in general. And a lot more scientists that are being helped being trained in the last couple of years in terms of engaging with the public, they are understanding the value of that as well. So another thing, I'm currently doing a BA in policy studies at UNISA, and I'm learning so much about the policy pipeline, and I'm very excited to see just what is happening with the Department of Science Technology, Science Technology and Innovation when it comes to science engagement and science communication. That I'm excited for the future of science communication in South Africa, that it's being taken seriously, and also that there's a long-term plan to make it a thing, that it's no longer just a tick box exercise, something that you just do I communicated the science, it's out there. What impact does that have? It should be second nature that if you're a scientist, you also do science communication, that sort of thing. And I'm really excited to continue talking about science in my own work and having others as well talk about science. And the technology that we have these days makes it so important to quickly dispel a lot of disinformation about scientific things happening, and also to just for South Africans to understand the immense pride with regards to science that we're doing as a country, to know that we have awesome scientists here and this is the work that they're doing, because the science is there but not many people know about it, right? And it was a big important thing that happened when during COVID our scientists found through a lot of analysis, they found a couple of variants, including the Omicron variant, that was unfortunately disparagingly named the South African variant.
And hey, man.
The global scientists found it in South Africa, but it was South African scientists who were doing the work and found, we kept finding a lot of these, these variants. It was because of the amazing investments that have been made into science, scientific research in the country, and science communication, that we were able to have that sort of capacity. We have the SKA, right? We have all these amazing institutions like the CSIR, all these different universities creating these innovations, creating these amazing people who come out of those institutions. And I want people to be aware of those things that are happening, and I'm very glad I'm very optimistic about the future of science communication in the country, and I'm very happy to be a part of that going forward, to help shape it in some way and to take part in it, to make sure that the policies the policies hit the ground in such a way that they do the best, the most good that they possibly can.
So how can young communicators and scientists get involved in shaping the future of science communication in Mzansi?
I would say quickly, it's to just to try to satisfy your curiosity. Don't try not to grow out of it. So with the work that I do at the SABC, including with the graphics that I do as well, I do a lot of things that are difficult. As journalists, we are not experts in a lot of the things that we cover. That's why we usually interview experts and things like that. But the fun part is that we can learn, right? So having that curiosity as a young communicator is just, don't be a full cup yourself. You are able to share knowledge with others because you remember that you are someone who used to not have that knowledge. As long as you remember how you were able to learn that knowledge, how it benefited you, you can transfer those skills onto others. That's my approach for science communication, is that I try to explain things to people the way I learned them, the way I understood them, because knowing how I learned them and how I understood them, it puts me in the shoes of the person before they know the information that I'm about to give them. I used to be in their shoes, right? So what would have been an approach that would have not worked? I would not have liked being told that maybe when it comes to stuff like vaccines, I should use my brain. I'm an idiot. This is how vaccines actually work. yes, you might be correct in telling me that's how vaccines work, but that approach, throwing facts at me, doesn't really work because that's not what worked for, right? Mm-hmm. You have to understand that people have this idea about science that it's difficult to understand, that it's tough, that it's not for them, right? And having that understanding and understanding your audience is just tenets of communication. I can't believe I haven't said it yet, which is know your audience, right? Mm-hmm. And then cater to them in that sense. Like, knowing your audience means understanding what they know, what they don't know, the misconceptions they might have, what power they have, in terms of what are they going to do with the knowledge that you give them. So that's a big factor in that. So always have that empathy of putting yourself in the shoes of the audience that you are talking to. If you don't understand your audience, it's okay. You are someone who's in their shoes now because you don't understand your audience. Go out there, find resources, learn more about them so that you can cater to them in the best way that you can. So, yeah, that would be my big advice for young science communicators is to know your audience, put yourself in their shoes, and understand who they are so that you can give them what they need.
Okay, Mr. Viela, thank you so much. This was very informative, first of all, and you were breaking everything down, trying to make it sound very simple to us. We appreciate the time for you to actually come through to the show and actually give us all this information. We truly appreciate it. If people want to connect with you, where can they find you? If they want to ask for a piece of advice or follow your work, where can they find you?
Oh, yeah. They can find my retweet on what used to be Twitter. I am Astro Sibs. And you can also find me on LinkedIn if you want to follow some of the work that I have been doing. Yeah, those are the two big ones on X, Astro Sibs, and then on LinkedIn, Sibusiso Biela, if you want to find me.
Mr. Biela, thank you so much for your time. Have a wonderful evening, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Bye. Science Wise on Vow.